this week on the Back Table Podcast.
But I would say it's a fascinating thing that including transgender, gender diverse individuals in that effort, I'd say, is underappreciated and is something that we're doing more and more. And they have to have a voice in this because as a cisgender male, how would I really deeply understand their issues and their challenges and things? So having some insight and perspective is key.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Backtable ENT podcast, where we discuss all things ENT. We bring you the best and brightest in our field with the hope that you can take something from our show to your practice. My name is Gopi Shah. I'm a pediatric ENT, and this is part two of a series with Dr. Daniel Knott and Dr. Rahul Seth, trailblazing otolaryngologists out of San Francisco. Part one was on facial masculinization in gender-affirming care, which is available for you to listen to. In part two, Dr. Knott and Dr. Seth are going to talk to us about the impact that ENTs can have on gender-affirming care. Welcome back to the show. How are you guys doing?
Thank you, Gopi. We're doing great. Really enjoying this.
So let's do an intro. Let's set the stage. Just for any of our listeners who maybe didn't catch our initial episode, can you just tell us what it means to be transgender or gender diverse and what it means to transition?
Yeah. So Gopi, thank you so much for having us. This is a really important topic. We're excited to discuss this as the second part of our series. It means a lot to us. And I know the whole ENT community, there's a lot of people who are active in this field, and I hope we can be the voice of that group and the voice of those patients as well for whom we provide care. And in this specialty area, it's care to transgender and gender diverse individuals. And your question was, what does that really mean? So there's a couple key vocabularies here to talk about, and that is a difference between sex and gender. Sex is an attribute given to an individual based off of physical characteristics that are present or not present at birth. And gender is the way an individual identifies in a very deep way with themselves in terms of being a man, woman, boy, girl, or anywhere along the gender spectrum. And not only how they identify and relate to themselves and view themselves, but also how they present to the world and to society around themselves. So a cis man is somebody assigned sex at birth, male, and also living his life as a man. A trans man is an individual assigned at birth as female, but living a life and living in society, presenting as a man. So hopefully that helps set the stage with some of the vocabularies. Dr. Knott, if you have any clarifications.
Yeah, no, I think it's important to think about the patient as a whole and understand that most of our patients really feel this sense of gender dysphoria, that they really feel like they're in the wrong body. And most of them, if you explore during your consultation, you'll realize that they had the sensation from the very beginning. As soon as they kind of became conscious of their bodies and themselves, they felt that they were miscast essentially in life and put in the wrong body. And when one thinks about all the struggles that you go through in adolescence, as you're trying to be accepted by your peer group and fit in, and we all want to be recognized and accepted for being who we are and validated and included in our peer groups. The transgender individuals, they suffer perhaps the most stigmatization and the biggest barriers to feeling like they can be accepted for who they are. And they get rejected by their peers and their parents and their friends and their teachers. So they suffer so much exclusion in their lives that to transition really means for them to, in a sense, become reborn into the individual that they have always felt that they should be. It's a really profound kind of reemergence, a renaissance for themselves whenever they're at the point in their lives to pursue this. And it's not something that's done without deep and profound preparation, thought process, counseling, support. So it is to transition, you know, we talk about the gender reveal when the dress has come off. Really, it's a process that started really early on in their lives. And we're kind of at the tail end of trying to help them recognize this dream that they've had for most of their lives.
So you touched upon it. I was going to ask you, what are some of the social and medical challenges this group of patients faces? And you touched upon whether it's acceptance from peers, family, school, teaching, and I think of housing and homelessness and poverty. And I think in your ENT Today article in 2020, sorry, I keep referencing those articles because I think they're so good. You guys talk about some of these issues that these patients face. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the social medical challenges that these patients have?
I mean, I think when you think about barriers to care, we all take for granted that when we're sick, when we're struggling, when we have an issue with our bodies, it's easy. You just make your appointment, you see your physician or your healthcare provider, and you get care. These individuals, they face stigma from the moment they make that phone call or walk in the doctor's office. And so to find individuals who can provide them gender-affirming care, but as we discussed earlier, if they have a sore throat or if they have an earache, no matter where they're going, and to not even touch upon the entire gynecological, obstetrical aspects of it as well, which is also a profound issue. There are perhaps no areas of greater barriers to access of care in our country than for the transgender and gender diverse population.
And there's a growing population of individuals who identify as trans and gender diverse. And that's the umbrella term that we use to be most inclusive. And with that, as a medical field and medical providers, we are obligated to take down those barriers that Dr. Knott was mentioning and understand that patients are going to come to us for all sorts of needs that are related to their gender identity and most often completely not related to their gender identity. And there's this concept in medicine that's really taking over called determinants of health. And that includes, as you mentioned, housing, education, support, habits of lifestyle. And many of those, data has shown, are severely compromised in our transgender populations, all the way from housing instability to increased rates of smoking in our patients that we need to take into consideration and really be able to help our patients out where they need it the most.
And if you think about all of the measures of social instability, struggle, criminality, violence, suicidality, loss of employment status, basically any measure in our social structure for stability, the transgender, gender diverse population scores much lower, tremendously lower on those scales than the cisgender population.
And really, Dr. Knott, there's this concept that we've written about that's intersectionality of biases and of barriers. And what that really means for the audience is that you have cumulative areas of challenges that almost are multiplicative in your ability to access care, maintain health. And there's a whole host of data out there that really demonstrates that Black women, because of the intersectionality of those two characteristics, it really leads to poorer health outcomes. And it really shines out in the transgender population, as you were mentioning, all those things become not just additive, but they seem multiplicative.
And in terms of the role of the otolaryngologist, you know, in terms of when a patient transitions or they're on their journey, they may want to address their voice. And so maybe I need to see the speech and language pathologist or the laryngologist. Or there are some things about my facial characteristics that maybe I would want to see a facial plastic surgeon about. But tell me, is there a role for the otolaryngologist? Do you have to be a laryngologist or a facial plastic surgeon to be relevant in this care?
I think it's a great question. And I think it really depends upon your practice expanse. Because of if you imagine a list of all the potential procedures that you'd be performing on these patients, from fillers to implants to hair treatments to the voice surgery versus just speech therapy, so much of the potential interventions in the face and neck are performed by otolaryngologists. So yes, I think there is a particular focus for laryngologists and facial plastic surgeons. But overall, well-trained otolaryngologists, I think, should be front and center in terms of the discussion about treatment for this population.
And just like any other patient, somebody who's cisgender or transgender can get tonsillitis. And so really having a baseline understanding of, you know, how to appropriately address or call trans patients by appropriate genders, pronouns, and name, and having them have an acceptable environment where one feels safe to receive appropriate medical care is paramount. There's a really nice comparison study that shows the population density across the United States of the general population on a map, and then shows the population density of survey respondents who identify as trans or gender diverse. And the heat map is identical for the two. So the takeaway is the notion that, you know, you might not work or live in an urban environment, so you won't see patients who identify as trans or gender diverse. That's not really probably applicable. And patients may not be forthcoming because you may not be open, but trans and gender diverse patients are everywhere in our world and our society, and having an open environment really makes us better at giving them the care that they need.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I think about it, it's whether I'm going to be the one doing gender affirming voice surgery, for example, versus if I'm taking care of a gender diverse patient that has had cancer, you know, I still need to be able to at least medically look at the medication list, right? Or before we get there, how do they want to be called? What pronoun does this person prefer? What medications are they on? What surgeries have they been? All that, I should at least, if anything, understand sort of what is the healthcare aspect, you know, what is medically and surgically, and then in addition to the social and potentially mental health and everything else that are some of the challenges that these patients face, just so that I can understand this patient and realize that the needs might be a little different, or, hey, I need to think about, there's a few other things I need to think about, or at least I should be able to ask those questions and start with a rapport so that if it's head and neck cancer, that outcome is going to be better if I can understand exactly where this patient's coming from. So I agree. I don't, whether you're doing the high-end voice surgery or super uber niche facial masculinization surgery, we all need to be able to be open to, hey, these patients are everywhere, and we should at least be able to have some knowledge and background and be educating ourselves.
And Gopi, if I could interrupt, I would even say that as a pediatric otolaryngologist, I mean, given that this whole concept of gender fluidity is so much more embraced by the younger patients, I would imagine that a pediatric otolaryngologist would have a healthy amount of patients in his or her practice or their practice. And I think sensitivity, understanding, and knowing, you know, who to refer to, who to contact,
absolutely,
how to develop a network to support your patient's mental and psychosocial and physical well-being would be critical.
Absolutely. I think in the pediatric world, you know, the AAP is such a strong society when it comes to education and advocacy for gender-affirming care. And as we said, a lot of gender identity can start early. We see it expressed in our adolescence as well. And so sometimes it's just educating ourselves of the kids come in with their parents. What's the dynamic? Have they put a preference for their pronoun? Is it okay to ask that question? And I also think it depends on where you are in the US right now, because of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, especially in our kids and our adolescents, of being able to, quote, provide that care or not. But we can kind of get into some more of that later, but you're absolutely right. It's very relevant in our practices and being able to have those resources and that support, because that rapport with the parents has to be established as well as the patient in the pediatric world too. When we think of affirmation and we say gender affirming care, what exactly does that mean? And what's the impact when you are able to affirm somebody's gender?
I think our population, they really live much of their lives in the shadows and worried about acceptance and being misgendered, and the amount of negativity heaped upon them is shocking. And so I think to affirm them, I think, is a beautiful term, because it allows our patients to decide for themselves what their gender should be. And then we are of service to them to enable them to recognize and realize this internal sense of who they are. And so we're allowing this internal kind of flower to basically open up and become recognized by their peers and their society for who they are inside. And so to affirm them means to serve them in their process of discovery in our sense, I mean, there's perhaps no greater forward-facing part of your gender identity than your face. I mean, that's our eyes and our minds are so clever at instantly recognizing telltale features that I think there's perhaps no other part of the body that we could work with more so than the face in terms of allowing them to be affirmed in who they want to be.
The face is a primary means of social communication without even saying anything. And biologically and evolutionarily, that has what's developed is exactly what Dr. Nott is saying, is that we take a glance, even in a second, at looking at somebody, and we gain automatically so much knowledge about them. And the other thing that we're biologically wired for is if there's something incongruent that's going on, in the sense that, okay, somebody has a feminine name, a feminine pronoun, but their face appears masculine, our brains are almost hardwired to say, okay, something's not right there. And then every step thereafter is not of the normal cycle. And that creates a very big challenge for the transgender diverse patient to have day-to-day interactions that are meaningful. And I think a lot of people don't really understand what it's like, but yet lend opinions on this. But it's just hard to imagine life where every interaction that you have starts off in an awkward way or in a way that is just not natural. That really puts the individual at a disadvantage. And to affirm that patient really allows them to function in a society in a meaningful way so that they can live their best life and have interactions like the rest of us do. And I think that's fair and well deserved for any individual.
Tell me a little bit about, I want to talk about access to care. And I realize that access to care is going to depend on where you are today and in which state you are, really. You know, there were the two articles juxtaposed. One was the one about your practice in California, and the one above it was the example was, I think, Tennessee. I mean, we can use that same example right now, whether it's Texas, Florida, and the other multiple states that I think were in the teens or even in the 20s now of the number of states that are banning or passing pretty limited restrictions to coverage of care. Tell me a little bit about California, about the healthcare system in California and what you've seen in your practice when it comes to access to care for these patients and how having more favorable state laws have been helpful.
So it's so nice to hear that you've been reading our papers.
They're so good. I was so excited that there's other otolaryngologists that are passionate about this and are pushing the envelope a bit, because I think it's very insightful when you can reflect on your practice and then also put it in a greater context when it comes to social politics. And at the end of the day, it's advocacy. And it's hard to do that, I think, sometimes as subspecialists. We don't always know how to think that way. It's not part of our training. It's not in our, quote, ENT DNA, but it's great to be able to have that perspective.
Well, we sit in our living rooms late at night writing these things, and then you just don't know who reads them and how it's received. You don't get so much feedback. So it's so nice to find that our words are echoing in a really positive way. So thank you for that. As physicians, our role is to take care of our patients, and we have this tremendous ability to do so. And it's this really privileged place to be. And it's sad when the politics and the social structures try to dictate to us. And it's such a divisive, controversial thing. And it's such a shame, because really, at the end of the day, we're there to take care of our patients. And it's not for me to dictate what my politics are onto my patients' backs. But I really am there to, you know, support them. And so in California, and just to back up, insurance support, financial flows, money really dictates so fundamentally the access of care for our patients. And in our country right now, it's such a patchwork quilt of state-based regulations that provide access for care and insurance support for our patients. And so the mere fact of being born in Mississippi or Arizona or Michigan dictates so fundamentally what your pathway is going to be for access for the transgender, gender diverse population. It's tragic, sad, and challenging. And I think if we're going to leave politicians to dictate this for our patients, it's very frustrating because they have all of their own agendas. So I find that intensely frustrating. And so in San Francisco, it really is kind of a mecca city for patients seeking acceptance and access for maybe more liberal-based ideas. And so we see patients in our practice that have come from all over the country because of the fact that they were seeking an environment that was more accepting of them and would allow them to further this journey because of the barriers are so much lower in San Francisco. I'll turn it over to Dr. Seth.
Yeah. And just to start, Gopi, we're just thrilled that somebody reads what we wrote. So thank you for reading a couple of our articles. So
let's thank Robin Lindsay, the editor that is, you know, that's like, yes, this is important and we're going to put it out there.
And also for thanking our most recent one in ENT Today that you have referenced. Big shout out to Dr. Suresh Mohan, who's the first author of that article. He was our fellow in facial plastic surgery last year. He just recently joined Yale. So he did a great job in helping to put this together. So definitely want to give him a shout out for that work. And then, you know, California has done a nice job of making sure that our patients aren't discriminated against. And I think one of the main aspects that plays into that is understanding that there are certain things that we can do for a patient that are so impactful that it can completely change the direction of their life. From having a suicide rate that's 10x of the population that is present amongst our trans patients, we can align resources and care to really help and change that for an individual. That has just an exponential effect on life and society and such an investment in the population. If we can even help somebody with their gender dysphoria so that they don't have to be on certain medications or frequent therapy, that itself is decreasing the burden of care. And when it comes to cost-benefit analysis, and I think California has understood that there's a benefit just there when it comes down to investment and resources, but also in the lives of its constituents. I'm so thankful to be in a community. And that's actually how Dr. Knott and I got started in this line of surgical work, was by having the county of San Francisco reach out to us for assisting in the care of their patients. And it's kind of extended from that. And I know anecdotally, the two of us could give so many stories about how impactful the work has been for us. One of the analogies we will often use is we'll do these big cancer reconstructive surgeries and patients will say, you know, doc, thank you for saving my life, along with the ablative surgeon. And it's really interesting to have the same exact reaction from our gender-affirming surgical patients. Thank you for saving our lives. That's extremely meaningful. And I personally don't find that in other areas of work that I do, but it goes to show how impactful this is.
You'd mentioned insurance support and financial support. Does California Medicaid cover gender-affirming surgery? Is that difficult to find coverage? Are there health insurance plans that cover gender-affirming care? Because we know it's nice because you do have experts and multidisciplinary clinics. So the access to go to the clinic is there in California, which in a lot of states, unfortunately, has been more and more difficult. But in terms of financial support, tell me about that.
Yes. So California does support transition-related services. And so Medicaid does pay for our transgender and gender diverse patients to seek care. And that is critical because many of our patients, as we described earlier, suffer socioeconomically. As Dr. Seth so eloquently put it, they're from the very beginning of any social interaction, they're stigmatized. And so that has all kinds of consequences socioeconomically. But so many of them could not afford to undergo surgical transition if they didn't have some kind of governmental insurance support. And these patients traditionally have had to go abroad to undergo surgery or simply couldn't afford surgery. And so they had to live their lives without ever being able to recognize the potential gain of surgical intervention. But yes, Medicaid does pay for this.
And for the patients that are out of state, then that seek care, those I would assume are cash then, because they would not be California residents to get California Medicaid or to be able to get on a private insurance based out of California.
So we have patients that come to us who do pay cash, but many of them come to California, establish residence, gain Medicaid, and then, because the process, again, takes, it's a prolonged process of support. Living a year in the gender that they're choosing to enter into, a sort of year of lived experience. So it takes time to, and then to come in to see us and schedule and coordinate. And so it's a long process.
And when it comes to commercial insurances, there's a large variety of how the plans may cover it. So some out-of-state commercial plans do cover out-of-state providers. And then when it comes to Medicaid, as Dr. Knott was saying, those are typically actually county-based. And all of this really came about through the Insurance Gender Non-Discrimination Act that came about, which said that insurance health plans in California can't exclude certain coverage based on sexual orientation or gender identity. And the interpretation of that law, along with the Affordable Care Act, that also stated similar non-discrimination by health plans to achieve care of the individual, is really set forward the ability for the patients to get the surgeries or care that they need.
Dr. Seth co-authored a paper on this exact topic with a group from Mass Eye and Ear, Dr. David Shea, about the coverage of both facial feminization or facial gender affirming surgery and chest and genital surgery.
Tell me what you think are the persistent barriers still in California regarding access to care.
So even though there's laws passed, as we well know, insurance companies can make their own internal rules and decisions of medical necessity as they desire. So I will say that one major barrier that we see is individual medical directors making judgments. Oh, you know, I think this patient looks feminine enough. Well, it's not really up to that person. And often our patients will have to, not often, but sometimes our patients will have to engage in advocacy or potentially appeals and complaints to finally get an approval and authorization based upon the laws in California. So just because there's a law doesn't mean that it's followed. With every law, there's loopholes and challenges. And so still, it's persistently a problem.
Many of the surgeries we perform are, of course, by their very nature, focused on appearance. And so there's this just tremendous deep misunderstanding about the goals of the surgeries, because it's seemingly all about appearance and it's cosmetic, and why is insurance paying for it? And it takes a lot of redirection to make people understand that we're addressing a fundamental deep-seated gender dysphoria. And all of the surgeries are so-called, quote, aesthetic. They really are part and parcel for allowing these patients to transition effectively and to live a life in their gender of choice. And so I think there is a deep, persistent misunderstanding about this population and about the treatments for them, even in California.
I wanted to talk a little bit about education, because I think that's probably one of the underpinnings of continued misunderstanding or misperception. But I wanted to talk about education specific in ENT when it comes to gender-affirming care. You guys are in San Francisco. You have state laws that allow you to practice this care. There at least is some legislation about insurance coverage, and you are performing surgeries. To be specific about surgical training among our programs, you know, I wonder if we're going to see, do you think that there are discrepancies when it comes to training, when it comes to surgery for gender-affirming care in our programs? Because if you have state laws that prohibit it or make it very difficult to access, then those patients aren't going to be able to come to you.
We did a survey with our dermatology colleagues about access to gender-affirming care in training programs and found that the percentage of programs that did have access to gender-diverse individual-specific training is this extreme minority. And really, it's, again, it's based upon access to that exposure and education really is state-based. And Dr. Seth and I have found this deep interest in this topic, and we've been invited to speak at a large number of institutions and states across the country because of the fact that there's such a dearth of knowledge and education that many programs and people are deeply interested in expanding their own access and understanding in their own programs. So I see this as a potential area of tremendous growth, because without education, I think we'll never be able to address this deep misunderstanding of our patients.
And to the point that we were talking about earlier, it's not necessarily even a surgical education, but more of a cultural awareness and an awareness how to work with individuals who identify as trans and gender diverse in clinic. You don't have to be a specialist providing facial feminization surgery at all to breed that cultural awareness. And that's one of our, Dr. Knott and I's missions when we go and give these talks, is for providers to understand and embrace that and carry that forward and hopefully make an impact on the provider as they continue. I will say it really behooves our national academies, the American Academy of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery, American Academy of Facial Plastic Surgery, to put forward advocacy in this area and education. I do know that recent years they have pushed that forward, and there's always room for greater amounts of understanding. But Dr. Knott, when I will tell you that, you know, in the last 5 years, we went from fellowship applications not really seeking an interest and coming to us because we offer this, to now it being a potentially significant focus of our applicants of gaining this knowledge base. So there is a change in the educational surgical world for sure that's happening.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up both of those points. Dr. Knott specific to surgical training and Dr. Seth specific to cultural context, because you really need both. And I kind of think about it sometimes just because I have a big interest in medical education in terms of it's got to be shown as valued and relatable. And so I always wonder when it comes to gender affirming care, because it can be such this political, there's such a context with that, is the relatability, do we start with clinical education? Because clinical education, meaning what are the surgeries out there? What's the role of speech path? What are these patients presenting with? Is something that we all can kind of relate to, right? It's, we're all clinicians and we all see patients. And I feel like if we can make that valuable and show that, hey, this is a very important part of in our field, then hopefully it's not so difficult to bring in the cultural context. Because I do think, you know, when we're talking about gender diverse, transgender, LGBTQ, I do think history and social and political context are important and they matter. But how we present all that, the order in which and the context, when you think about those things and relatability, what are your thoughts on that?
Thank you. So the way we like to, and I hope I'm answering this question correctly, because I think it's a really important one. When it comes to education, how do we allow the learner or the surgical trainee to understand that this is not just niche, it's fundamental to a deeper understanding? And I will say that one, especially in the facial plastics world, we've often taken an understanding that when you're doing a rhinoplasty on an individual who's male, you don't want to overly feminize that nose. And so there is a baseline understanding of femininity and masculinity as it comes to characteristics. But beyond that, we know that the inherent application of the way that the face appears, whether masculine or feminine, relates very much directly with attractiveness of the face and the biological ability of the individual to look average, you could say, which is one of the goals of attractiveness. So we like to break it down into a base understanding of the importance of the concepts of attractiveness, which are symmetry, averageness, sexual dimorphism, and youthfulness. And sexual dimorphism is the femininity or masculinity of that face, and understanding the biologic importance of that and how that plays with attractiveness and normalness of a face. And then really understanding facial analysis from the terms of those. And then it begins to click to the learner or to what we're trying to accomplish, that this is something greater than just facial feminization surgery. This is applicable to all individuals, and approaching the face in any aspect of ENT that can change the appearance of the face really has its core concepts united with what we're talking about.
And as Dr. Seth and I are trying to promote our work and think about how we can do so, our studies and brow height and 3D morphology and implants, all that is based on scientific results or the classical kind of scientific paper. But it's really important for our societies, Alex Chu and now Robin Lindsay at ENT Today, to give us a platform to also discuss some of the social insurance-based ideas that perhaps don't fit neatly packaged into a scientific paper, but do help us guide our specialty and provide a voice of change and a different opinion. And the same thing happens at our meetings, that we have to be given a platform to then speak about this, talk about this, and show that this is an important part of our work in our academies.
You touch on advocacy, and I think that you bring up different ways, whether it's bringing up at our societies, using the platforms that we do have through our ENT like newsletters, maybe giving talks in the community, coming onto a podcast platform. You know, this is a way to get knowledge and awareness out there. I do think advocacy is something that we don't really talk about formally in our training or when we're practicing, but so much of what we do and so much of what's going on in the world, I think our voices matter, and there's so many different ways. And so it is refreshing when we meet other people that put their voice out and put it into a context, because it pushes the envelope and it makes us think. In terms of research, how should we design or think about studies when we're looking at gender diverse patients? And who do you collaborate with? Are there other departments, or do you ever include members, gender diverse or transgender members in the community to fill in those blind spots?
So Dr. Seth and I have formed collaborations, you know, both nationally with other centers of excellence that do this. A shout out to Dr. Jeff Spiegel, who again was kind of fundamental in our own development as surgeons in this area. But both in our societies, we have collaborations with our fellows that have gone on to do work in this field, like Dr. Michael Nwara up in Oregon, for example. And then we collaborate, you know, across our institutions with dermatology, the Transgender Center, the general plastic surgeons. So we work with them in doing this. And then Dr. Seth has formed a powerful collaboration with academics in Canada and then with epidemiologists, trying to think about the problems and solutions in a different way and bring in different stakeholders into this. But I would say it's a fascinating thing that including transgender, gender diverse individuals in that effort, I'd say, is underappreciated and is something that we're doing more and more. And they have to have a voice in this, because as a cisgender male, how would I really deeply understand their issues and their challenges and things? So having some insight and perspective is key.
It makes me think of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. You know, they always have patients or parents when it comes to their clinical consensus or new research and guidelines, because having them at the table, it brings in the perspective that those of us that don't have, whether it's cystic fibrosis or are not transgender, we're not going to see it. We're going to not be able to think about it because it's not in our lived experience necessarily.
The other part is, I think because we're involved in so much patient care and many clinical-based research or even non-clinical-based research comes from questions in the clinic, which can often come by just listening to our patients. And so a lot of times the patient will say, well, do you think I need fat added to my cheeks, and how much to feminize my face? And so, well, that's a great actual question. And the next question they ask is, I wish there was some research that said. And then just involving your patients and your daily interactions with forming questions that can help inform our field and grow it in a way that's meaningful is really important. So just having presence of mind and involving just our daily interactions, I think is key to developing any field, especially this one, where fundamentally it is based on advocacy. And the other thing that I will say is that it's sometimes individuals in our fields, we're all super busy. There's just constantly so much to do. And the notion comes about, well, how can I actually do this or fit this in? And it is really hard to accomplish and to advance things. At the same time, all it does is take one individual. It's not that, well, I'm just one person. But just like Dr. Knott was mentioning, that there are more providers who in your field and others who have the same questions and really come together at that question jointly and working together really begins to breed a sense of advocacy and growth in understanding a field.
So as we wrap up this episode, I hate that it comes to an end. I could probably talk to you guys for hours actually about this. Any final pearls that you might have from whether regarding access to care, education, advocacy, research, anything else that you would like to add?
I might want to just close on saying that I think it's important for any provider, because I think the listenership is going to be mostly otolaryngologists here perhaps, but it's important that you don't insert yourself as a filter between the patient and their outcomes. I had so many unconscious biases myself. And it was only by engaging with my patients and trying to explore their wishes, I slowly began to recognize my own biases and then tried to selectively remove them. Because again, my role was really to help my patients recognize their dreams. And it doesn't require me to insert these stopgaps or act barriers or predetermined notions in that. So I would just also encourage your listeners to be gentle and kind to themselves. This is a difficult topic, and it's one that requires forgiveness, and our patients are very forgiving, and just your very means of trying to help them will make all the difference in the world. And so do your best efforts, be forgiving, you will get better at it, you will understand better, and you'll move forward and be a huge advocate or a benefit for them.
And even if you're in a state that doesn't allow for transgender care, you as an otolaryngologist or any background have a really important role in the advocacy of your patient. And you may recognize that there's a role to help that individual. And no matter what it is of your background, you don't have to be a specialist. You will see most likely a patient who's trans and gender diverse. So to keep an open mind and just like Dr. Knott said, understand that you're not going to be perfect and no one else expects you to be perfect. And this is a growth process for all of us.
Thank you guys so much for your time and coming on. I learned a ton. For our listeners, don't forget to listen to part one with Dr. Knott and Dr. Sith on facial masculinization surgery. Please check out other episodes on Backtable ENT with gender affirming care, episode 125, gender affirming voice care with Dr. Mark Corey and speech and language pathologist Sarah Snyder, and episode 27, facial feminization with Dr. Sarah Saxon. In the show notes, we're going to include the ENT Today articles by Dr. Knott and Dr. Seth on gender-affirming care. And please don't forget to check out the Otolaryngologic Clinics North America, August 20, 2022. And of course, the chapter in Operative Techniques in Otolaryngology 2023 on facial masculinization with Dr. Knott and Dr. Seth. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you for having us.
It's a wrap. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us at @BacktableENT on Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter. Backtable ENT is hosted by Gopi Shaw
and Ashley Agan.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles,
Nick Shellcross,
and Ness Smith-Savadoff.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz, with support from
Taylor Spurgeon-Hess and Yvonne Ovijinsky.
Social media and PR by Chi Ding.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Thanks again for listening, and see you next week.